This is The Rounds Table. All right, welcome back, Rounds Table listeners. Another very exciting episode in store for you today. I'm joined again by Dr. Leah Karyannopoulos, and she is going to be discussing the Timeless Trial. Leah, what on earth is the Timeless Trial?
Great name, hey? It is the tenecteplase for stroke at 4.5 to 24 hours with perfusion imaging selection. This was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in February of 2024.
All right. Yes, tenecteplase, a drug I'm certainly familiar with when I am the sort of stroke on-call doc in Sault Ste. Marie. But this isn't about me. What was the research question for this timeless trial?
Yeah, so the question here was, in patients presenting with an ischemic stroke 4.5 to 24 hours after being last seen well, does the administration of tenecteplase versus placebo improve their functional outcomes?
Okay, and yeah, why did this catch your eye?
I think we're all very familiar with the fact that intravenous lytics have generally been the standard of care for patients presenting with ischemic stroke. But based on the evidence we have to date, we tend to limit the administration of this drug to within 4.5 hours of onset, which, as you can imagine, can be a limitation in terms of treating patients that present later or that wake from sleep with symptoms. But we know that for patients presenting outside this window, we avoid these medications because, again, previous studies have shown a higher risk of intracranial hemorrhage, which is obviously not a nice consequence of this treatment. The evidence in this area, the treatment in this area, has been evolving a lot, however, such that a recent meta-analysis showed that the use of alteplase in the 4.5 to 9-hour window may be beneficial in select patients who have evidence of viable tissue on CT or MRI-guided perfusion imaging. So in that study and that analysis, however, these patients didn't receive endovascular thrombectomy, which has also become the standard of care for large vessel occlusions when imaging demonstrates salvageable tissue. So all that to say that we've had a pretty large evolution in how we image and how we treat these patients. And so it was felt that there may be benefit in revisiting our previously established window and being a bit more intentional about who and how we choose to administer thrombolytics.
Yeah, the justification, I can follow that along, absolutely. but you really have to show me big time benefits, because we know from multiple randomized trials, you know, less than 4.5 hours, as you alluded to, that's the sweet spot. But let's see. Okay, so how did they design this study?
So this was a multi-center, double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized controlled trial, which is great. It's our gold standard. Our population was adult patients who were previously functionally independent, presenting with acute ischemic stroke due to specifically an internal carotid artery, ICA, or middle cerebral artery, MCA, stroke, and a last known well time of 4.5 to 24 hours, who could receive tenecteplase. So if they had other reasons why they wouldn't be eligible for this therapy, they wouldn't be included in the trial. They were required to have evidence of salvageable tissue, as determined by an initial ischemic core volume of less than 70 mils, a ratio of the volume of ischemic tissue to initial infarct volume of at least 1.8, or an absolute penumbra, it's like my favorite word, of at least 15 mils. So all that to say that it wasn't just all comers presenting after 4.5 hours, because why would we go back and re-ask the same question when we feel we have an answer? But instead, it was this 4.5 to 24 hours and evidence of some tissue that still has viability.
Yeah, that certainly makes sense. And it does really get into the weeds of the neuroimaging, which we're not going to talk about. But, you know, it's not so simple as, hey, no sign of bleed, give the TPA. There is much more nuance going into reviewing these perfusion imaging scans. But anyway, so yeah, what was their intervention?
Yeah, so here they looked at giving tenecteplase at a dose of 0.25 milligrams per kilo. The max dose is 25 milligrams, administered as an intravenous bolus over 5 seconds. And this was compared to placebo. So I think saline, if I remember correctly, in the study.
Yeah. And the outcome?
So the outcome was an ordinal score on the modified Rankin scale at day 90. What the heck does this mean? It's a measure of disability with a score that ranges from 0, meaning no symptoms, to 6, which is death. What I like about this scale is that it does capture death within it, because that can often be a limitation in using things like this. They also had the good sense to look at safety outcomes. So this included death, of course, up to day 30 and at 90 days, and symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage, which I think is probably something everyone would have been asking about. So ICH here was defined as an increase, in this case, worsening of at least 4 points on the NIHSS scale that was attributed to any intracranial bleeding within 36 hours of administration.
Yeah, and like you said, this Rankin scale, this is the go-to ordinal outcome for stroke trials, so it certainly makes sense that that's what they use for this primary outcome. And you're right, it includes death, so it avoids that pesky problem that can occur with competing risks if you don't consider death. So what did the included patients look like?
So they captured 458 patients here. The mean age across groups is about 72. 53.5% was female. Kind of interesting. Most trials that you look at, there's mostly men. So interesting to see a few more women here. 74% of the patients were white. 14% were black. I haven't listed the numbers of the other racial identities there, though. The median NIHSS was 12, which, remember that the max on that scale, I want to say, is 40, if I remember correctly. I'm about to embarrass myself if I get that wrong. Not wildly high, I guess I will say. And importantly, the median duration from the time they were last known well in both groups was about 12 hours. So certainly not pushing that 24-hour limit, but pretty far off that 4.5-hour as the lower cutoff. And an important point here is that clot retrieval, so endovascular thrombectomy, was performed in 77% of the patients in this study.
And can you remind me, where was this study performed?
It was based out of the U.S., so it was various trials across the U.S. So it kind of makes sense that the population reflects that.
Okay, yeah, of course. And then I have just asked ChatGPT, what is the highest NIHSS score? So you're pretty darn close. 42 is the highest score. But I would give you full points if I was marking that exam. And you're right. Like, it's important to be aware of that, because for a lot of the trials in the stroke literature that we would see in GIM, they're usually going to be mild stroke or high risk TIA. And typically an NIH less than 4 would be a mild stroke. Mm-hmm. Above 20 is usually severe, and, you know, 12 is sort of between the mm-hmm. two. So what did they find for their primary outcome?
So their primary outcome, as we said, was that modified Rankin, and the score was 3 across both groups. They translated this to an odds ratio of 1.13, which had a 95% confidence interval of 0.82 to 1.57. So it straddled that line of no difference, and we obviously, based on having an identical Rankin scale across both, can see that there was ultimately no difference between groups. Their other outcomes were the functional dependence, which in the tenecteplase group was 104 of 226. They defined functional dependence as a Rankin score of 2 or less. And then in the placebo group, it was 97 of 229. So that odds ratio was 1.18, with a confidence interval, again, that's like very similar to the previous one, 0.80 to 1.74. With respect to death within 30 days, 32 of 218 in the tenecteplase group died versus 32 of 214 in the placebo group. And then finally, the symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage within 36 hours, we saw 7 of 218 in the tenecteplase group and 5 of 214 in the placebo group. So no difference across all of these outcomes.
Okay. Yeah, I saw some people in the neurology world reviewing this trial on Twitter and saying that, you know, we need a better stroke assessment than the Rankin score. And they believe this really is going to be helpful. But I don't know if I buy that. I think there are some important limitations for this trial. But yeah, what limitations are there swirling around in your mind for this study?
I mean, from a methodological approach to the study, I don't have any big criticisms in terms of how they went about doing it. Fair, I think, to say that, you know, how we score and grade and look at competing risk does matter. But you kind of have to use the best thing available to you. And if the modified Rankin is what people kind of understand and can translate in their minds, then fair. And when you look at, they actually do a really nice job of breaking down in the paper in their figure one, the grouping of the modified Rankin by tenecteplase versus placebos. They show you a nice kind of comparator of each one, because one could argue that, okay, the median might be meaningless if it's heavily skewed one way or another, and they just happen to balance out. Like if I have some that come out with a zero and a bunch that end up dying and have a six versus the other group has everyone landing with a Rankin of three, how the heck do I interpret that? Like what does that mean in terms of patient importance and that competing risk? But when you look at the breakdown there of that modified Rankin scale at 90 days, I would argue that they're actually not all that different, even when you look at like 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 as groups. So I didn't get to see the discourse on this, and I'd be very curious to see what people have to say about it. I think for me, like less than a limitation, but more as an interesting takeaway, is just it's a really interesting examination of the evolution in practice necessitating revisiting approaches. And I think more and more we are seeing that, you know, using perfusion guided imaging as it becomes more available is really, I think, going to be the name of the game. It already kind of is. And so it's just helpful to highlight that we should go back and re-ask questions as things change.
Yeah, I hear you. But to be fair, this was like totally null trial. Like you're not going to start thrombolyzing people at the 23-hour mark, are
No.
you?
No, my takeaway is that we haven't changed anything. And we're going to continue to hold off tPA beyond this 4.5-hour window. But what I do think, like, I think the evolution and the addition of endovascular therapy for stroke does necessitate revisiting some of our approaches, recognizing that obviously there are geographic Agreed. Limitations. You need access to labs. Like one of the things they talked about in this trial was that their time to like needle for thrombectomy was a lot faster than other studies just by virtue of where it was conducted, which you kind of look at that and you're going, okay, well, what's the generalizability? Like think about even we're in Canada, think about people presenting in Blind River, for example, that need to get transferred over before they can get to thrombectomy. You're going, okay, well, what am I going to do for these patients? Like how do I approach that group? And so certainly that generalizability is a little bit limited. But I do, I think that my big takeaway for this is that maybe revisiting the 0 to 4.5 hour time frame in terms of lytics versus just thrombectomy. And I know that they've looked at lytics alone or thrombectomy alone versus thrombectomy plus lytics and seen those outcomes. But I don't know, I think that the perfusion guided piece in combination with thrombectomy is going to merits more examination.
Yeah, I agree with you. The thrombectomy piece has been a complete and total game changer. The perfusion-based imaging, I guess I don't understand it, but also I hear people speculating too much. Oh, but because of this mismatch, we should give them tPA, even though it's 7 hours. So I get really worried when people look at pictures and then assume this picture is going to translate to a better benefit, even though that isn't supported by the trial. Yeah. And I think that's why I like this one, because it should hopefully give a lot of pause if somebody's past the 4.5 hour mark, but you're trying to do somersaults explaining, but based on this imaging with this penumbra, we might be able to do something. Probably not.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, you can massage data any which way you want, but I think that it's an important takeaway here that these patients were ones that you do hear that speculation around, you know, like they have viable tissue. So should we, is their risk of bleed different? And this is telling us that no, it might not show more harm, but it's certainly not showing benefit either. So why are we exposing them to this medication when we're not seeing that it helps in a meaningful way?
Yeah, completely. All right, wicked. Well, we're going to change gears. Before we do, you mentioned Blind River, which isn't too far from Sault Ste. Marie. And this episode has been brought to you by Sault Ste. Marie. So thank you to their support and ongoing support of the Rounds Table. You know, right now there's job opportunities for you know, generalists, specialists, you name it. If anyone wants to learn more, feel free to reach out to me. There's also opportunities for electives, for GIM residents from anywhere in Ontario. So far, almost all of them have been U of T, but one person reached out to me from McMaster Lea. So she joined me a few years ago now. So anyway, spread the word with any GIM residents you see on the wards.
Will do. Honestly, some of the best rotations I ever had and my favorite places to work are in these more rural communities. There's just such a richness there and so much to learn. So would recommend.
Totally. All right. So this trial is an open label randomized trial comparing fidaxomicin with oral vancomycin for the treatment of C. diff infection in hospitalized patients who are also receiving antibiotics for a concurrent infection, published in CID in February of 2024.
Perfect. And what's the, you kind of already said it, but what's the research question here formally?
What is the comparative efficacy of fidaxomicin versus vancomycin in the setting of C. diff when a patient also needs a concomitant antibiotic?
Perfect. And why is this important?
So I see quite a few patients that either come to hospital with C. diff or develop C. diff in hospital, and it's a really brutal infection. When I was reading this manuscript, it reminded me of something that I didn't know. So I don't think it's a reminder. It taught me something new, okay? I didn't realize that the recurrence rate is 22%. So 1 in 5 will get C. diff again. You know, that's extremely high. And as we all know, the major risk factor for C. diff is antibiotics. But for those individuals who have C. diff, but they truly need antibiotics for something else, those patients do even worse and have much lower cure rates based on other small studies.
That makes sense. It's totally, it comes up all the time, the C. diff, but they have bacteremia as well, or you're just dealing with such competing challenges and problems. So it's, I definitely buy into the importance of a solution here. Why don't you walk us through the study design?
So this was an open label randomized trial in two hospitals in Michigan. The population, adults with C. diff and receiving at least one, what they quote as high risk antibiotic for C. diff. In particular, the sort of inclusion and exclusion criteria are important to walk through. So this did not apply to somebody who had severe or complicated C. diff. It did not apply to somebody who up front, they were planned for a very long duration of C. diff treatment for like more than 10 weeks. It also didn't apply to adults who had already been treated for the C. diff for the past couple of days. So it really had to be new cases of C. diff in the individual who also needed an antibiotic for some other reason. That's probably the shortest possible version of the inclusion and exclusion criteria. The intervention, as mentioned, either fidaxomicin 200 milligrams twice daily for 10 days or oral vancomycin 25 milligrams orally 4 times daily for 10 days. 25 milligrams, that looks wrong. I'm going to have to double check the dose on that
125?
I'll ask. I think would be the... Yeah, 125. Thank you, Leah. Yeah. The primary outcome was clinical cure, which was resolution of diarrhea. Oftentimes, it was based on a phone call, you know, if the patient was already discharged from hospital. Mm-hmm. Very ambitious power calculation. So they assumed the cure rate with fidaxomicin would be 90%, whereas with vancomycin, it would be 75%. So they were powering for a 15% absolute risk difference and needed a sample size of approximately 200 individuals.
Got it. That is an ambitious sample. I'm impressed. What were... you already walked me through the primary outcomes. We're going to delete that. Why don't you walk us through the characteristics? What did these patients look like?
Yeah, so overall, 5,000 patients were screened and 144 were randomized. 70% were under the age of 65. 50% were women. 90% were white. 16% of patients were in the ICU. That's not a table one characteristic I usually report, but Leah, you're an ICU doctor, so I wanted to include that here.
Okay? I love it. I feel very special.
So just so you know, a small subset were ICU patients. 45% had cancer. The median white count was 8, which I just found that interesting because I remember the teaching point of, oh, you should think C. diff if the white count's like 25. But, you know, so much for that pearl based on this trial.
Yeah, I agree. That caught my eye too. Kind of like, oh, it's lower than I expected. What did they find? What were the results of the study?
So the trial was halted early due to a few reasons. Number one, slow enrollment. Number two, COVID. And number three, the IDSA guidelines were updated, and there was a recommendation that in general, you know, fidaxomicin should be the go-to agent over vancomycin. So trial stopped early. That's really important. Mm-hmm. But overall, among these 140 some odd patients randomized, the rates of cure, if you're, I guess, a real purist, no difference. But if you look at the numbers, the cure rate was 73% with fidaxomicin, 63% with vancomycin, but again, underpowered, stopped early. The recurrence risk of C. diff within the next 30 days was almost identical between the two groups, 3% versus 4%. The rates of adverse events really weren't different between the two. And then the overall 30-day mortality rate was pretty much 6% in both groups.
Got it. And can you remind me, when you say stopped early, how early are we talking? How many did they end up with in each group?
Yeah, good question. So they planned for 200 and their total sample size in the end was 144. Okay. But even that sample size of 200 was that was ambitious in like the wrong way.
Optimistic, yeah. Maybe. Wrongfully.
Yes,
optimistic.
There you go.
All right. Yeah. So I think we've already implied a few of them, but why don't you walk us through the limitations that you see here?
So it's a small trial. It's an unblinded trial. In an unblinded trial with a very subjective primary outcome can be very problematic. So if you go into this expecting fidaxomicin is going to be better and you call the patient with, hey, you know, how's your diarrhea? And they're like, oh, I still have a little bit. Okay, well, like, tell me more. Like a little bit or like none? Oh, no, I guess none. Oh, okay, cool. All right, none. We have a win. So it's just really easy to have your outcome affected when it isn't something black and white, mm-hmm. like dead or alive. So that's certainly problematic. But yeah, the size is the biggest issue here, or the smallest issue. The biggest issue because of the small size.
Fair enough. The stopping early is just... I will say I'm at least glad that it wasn't like halted due to such profound benefit that it would be wrong not to just stop and give this treatment to everyone. But the stopping early just, it drives me nuts. It's such a shame and such a sad waste of like resources, in my opinion.
Well, Leah, let me push back on that, actually. as somebody who's run a trial that was certainly stopped early, I agree with your sentiment for sure, but that's why we have stopping rules. That's why you have a separate committee that reviews it. And also, like the trial that I was a co-PI on of prone positioning, we were in the ambitious group of our sample size was way too small for the actual event rate. So I would argue it would have been wrong and real cruel torture and punishment to me to make me continue randomizing to the actual goal. You know, if you clearly are futile, boom, stop, end there. But you might disagree.
I hear you. I think this is one of my favorite debates because I don't think there's a right answer. Because absolutely, we do have good stopping rules. And that's the whole point of like data and safety monitoring groups and having these pre-established things. The challenge, you could make this argument about anything statistical based, is that they're often arbitrary. Like if you look at the options you have for statistical analyses and deciding when you should stop, there's so many variations on how you set those criteria. And I think we have good examples in history of times where stopping rules were met, we stopped, we went back for whatever reason, did a similar trial, and actually found that what we thought was beneficial was harmful, or what we thought was like, or it did nothing. So it's, it, like I said, I don't think there's a right answer, but I think should always be interpreted with caution, I guess, is when things are stopped early, you kind of need to really look at it and go, okay, but how sure am I of this?
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. And I think in particular, if you're stopping for benefit, mm-hmm. there should be even more, maybe some skepticism or really wanting to get a better sense of why, stopping for futility, stopping for harm. I'm less concerned on that. Mm-hmm. But you're right. You know, one of the great examples in the ICU world for stopping early because of quote unquote benefit was, you know, like very tight glycemic control in patients who were critically ill. And that initial study showed a massive benefit. And that led to new policy, especially in the US, where hospitals were penalized if they didn't have tight glycemic control. And I'm going to assume tight glycemic control is no longer the approach in the ICUs you work at.
It's not. And yet it's such an interesting example to raise because I have and I do work in ICUs where when you look at like the admission order sets, they actually still will default to suggesting tight glycemic or tighter glycemic control. So it's a perfect example of like the legacy of these things living on, even when it maybe shouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know, who knows if anyone's still listening, but the other reason why it's fascinating is because sometimes when trials stop early for a good reason, as in they found such massive benefits, there's other aspects to the trial, which were the real problem and not the stopping early. I'll give you a great example. In that first trial showing huge benefits for tight glycemic control in the ICU, it was a single center RCT. And somebody did a nice study recently where they looked at all of the single center RCTs published in New England, Lancet, JAMA, and asked the question, when the next trial was done and it was multi-center, could it reproduce the benefit? And 0% of the time they did that. But I'll have to check and see and how many of those also stopped because of the, you know, early stopping rules. Yeah. Anyway, this has been a fun tangent for me.
Took us right off. I distracted us. I think we need to come back. You haven't given us your take home point here.
Yeah. So take home point, fidaxomicin might be the ideal agent, but that's mainly based on other trials in these new IDSA guidelines rather than directly from this trial. So take home point here, you know, small studies will give you very, very uncertain results. And I will be honest, I've never actually used fidaxomicin before. Have you used it?
No, we're still very much vanco first.
Same. So maybe the take-home point is like guidelines can be discordant from care. Is it right? Is it wrong? I don't know. But it at least makes me think I should probably think about using fidaxomicin next time. But that's all I got for this trial.
I was going to say, is it going to change your practice? But maybe.
Maybe now I will prescribe it at some point in time. Maybe I have somebody who's quite sick with C. diff and I'm just so used to doing the exact same thing, which is vanco plus or minus flagyl. Mm-hmm. This will give me some pause to think, oh, geez, maybe I should ask somebody smarter than me. Should we be giving fidaxomicin? Mm-hmm. So anyway, end of the show. You know what, Leah? I think all the good stuff, we probably ate up our time with some very niche discussions about early stopping rules, unless there's some good stuff you just can't help yourself but to share.
No, I think any opportunity for debate is good enough for me, so I'm happy to leave it there.
Awesome. Okay, Leah, take care. Always fun to chat, and yeah, have a great weekend when it comes.
Likewise, take care.
The Rounds Table is hosted online at healthydebate.ca. Follow us on Twitter at Rounds Table. Thanks to our audio editors, Emilio Garcia Flores and Arjun Sharma. Also thanks to Amol Verma, founder of the Rounds Table, and Kieran Quinn, the previous director. We'd also like to give a big thanks to Seema Marwaha, editor-in-chief at Healthy Debate, for all the support.